is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Well, Council, you're going to be stuck with a handheld mic, I'm afraid. You'll either feel like a rock star, because that's what they always use, or it'll kind of get in the way of your argument. But either way, it's the best we can do today. For whatever reason, our microphones are giving us trouble. So, now, are you ready to proceed? Okay, then I will call our second case, City of Cedarburg versus Hansen. And when you talk into that microphone, you have to be sure it's getting picked up. If you get too far away from it, it doesn't tend to work. So, good luck.
Yes.
Into the microphone. We can hear you, but it's not from the microphone.
Not picking. Oh, there we go.
There you go.
Now you got it.
Once you get used to it, you'll figure out how it goes.
All right. Real good. Good morning, Justices. My name is Jonathan Woodward. I'm with Houseman and Find in Grafton. I serve as the municipal prosecutor for several communities in Ozaukee and Washington counties, including the city of Cedarburg, which is the plaintiff and appellant in this matter. When police arrest a driver on suspicion of OWI, police may fail to discover that the driver has one or more prior offenses, usually from out of state. When that happens, police may cite a driver for first offense OWI, whereas if they had known or discovered that prior out-of-state offense, police would have referred the matter to the district attorney for a criminal OWI charge. This court held in City of Eau Claire versus Booth that when this happens in a circuit court, it is a defect in the circuit court's competency, but not a defect in the circuit court's subject matter jurisdiction. The City of Cedarburg asks this court to hold that the same should be true when that mischarged OWI occurs in a municipal court for three reasons. First, a uniform traffic citation alleging a violation of a municipal ordinance falls squarely within the constitutional and statutory grant of subject matter jurisdiction to municipal courts. Therefore, as this court held in Booth, the defect is in the noncompliance with the statutory penalty scheme for OWI offenses. And that is fundamentally a question of court competency. Second, in light of this court's ruling in Booth, uniform traffic enforcement is best served by having the same rule that applies whether this factual circumstance happens in a circuit court or happens in a municipal court.
Counsel, do we determine the municipal court's jurisdiction based on what actually factually occurred or based on what the person was charged with?
I believe what Booth and the cases leading up to Booth tell us is that subject matter jurisdiction is a question of what type of case is before the court.
Right, and that seems to be the nub of the problem here. We're trying to figure out what was the nature of the case before the court.
Right.
Was it what was charged, or was it what actually occurred?
I believe that subject matter jurisdiction, in other words, the type of case, is determined based on the pleadings. You look at, in other words, a court looks at the four corners of the document before it to see what is alleged.
Even if it's alleged improperly. So you're basically saying that because they called it an ordinance, they could hear it even though it wasn't an ordinance?
Well, it was an ordinance because that's what the officer thought it was.
But it wasn't because there's no ability to charge something other than what in OWI world, because of, is it Roner, there's no ability to charge less. So there is no ability to charge this as an ordinance. If they had that ability, I would agree with you. Then they charged it that way, and that's fine. But because it can't be that, it can only be criminal. Just because they called it an ordinance, they thought it was an ordinance, that gives that court subject matter jurisdiction?
It gives the court subject matter jurisdiction because as far as anyone was concerned at the time, what was before the court was an action alleging a violation of municipal ordinance.
So it doesn't matter what it really is, it just matters what you thought it was.
where it matters what it really is in the competency analysis. Because competency, the law of competency, as Booth and the other cases have explained it, is that that is where you actually delve in to the facts of the particular case before the court.
I understand what you're saying, and the question I have is really goes back to what courts can do pursuant to the Constitution. So Booth focused on Article 7, Section 8, which gives jurisdiction to the circuit court regardless of whether it's municipal or not. And so Booth allowed the court, regardless of what it was, it could hear everything because it has a much broader grant. The grant for municipal courts, however, is very limited, and it's limited under Article 7, Section 14 to actions and proceedings arising under ordinances. And if this wasn't an ordinance, even if we called it one, it was not an ordinance violation. How could a municipal court have subject matter jurisdiction pursuant to the Constitution?
Right. And I think the answer to that question is how the matter actually arose. That's the constitutional language in Article 7, Section 14. Matters arising under the ordinances of the municipality. And from the perspective of police and from the perspective of the court, the matter arose under municipal ordinances. It was presented to the court as a municipal ordinance.
So you view arising to mean how it's presented, not what it actually is.
Right.
It doesn't arise under an ordinance because it actually was based on an ordinance. It arises when someone calls it something. That's your definition of arose to fit that.
It's based on the manner in which and the form in which it is presented to the court.
And where do you get that from? Do you have any case law to support what you're saying about the definition of arising?
So it comes from what this court recognized in Booth and Mikrut and the cases cited in those cases, which is that competency is a narrower inquiry than subject matter jurisdiction. This court has stated that subject matter jurisdiction is a question of the general class or the type of case before the court. And competency is an inquiry into the specific facts of the case that is before the court to determine whether the statutory prerequisites that would allow the court to exercise its jurisdiction have been met. And what this court stated in Booth is that when you have an issue of a mischarged OWI, the mischarging is a defect or a problem with complying with that statutory scheme. The penalties set forth in 346.65 sub 2, where as a person accumulates more OWI offenses, we penalize them more harshly, and offenses, generally speaking, second or subsequent, have a criminal penalty that attaches to them. But fundamentally, when the municipal court handled this case, the municipal court wasn't presented with a criminal complaint. There was no district attorney involvement. The municipal court was never being asked to exercise criminal jurisdiction. The municipal court was being asked to determine whether or not this individual violated a municipal ordinance.
Counsel, just to follow up on that, so what if they know there was a prior one, but nonetheless charge it as an ordinance?
Sure.
How does that fit into your theory? And then I have a follow-up after that.
Okay. Couple different responses to that. First of all, is I think that raises several other public policy issues which may or may not be germane to this case. This court recognized in Booth that forfeiture, in terms of whether or not a person forfeits their competency argument, is a rule of judicial administration. So if a municipal court at some later point in time was addressed with a situation where there was some bad act, in other words, a prosecutor undercharged something intentionally when they shouldn't have, a court would have the discretion to disregard the forfeiture of the objection because it wasn't timely raised and reach the argument. But the second response I would have to that is rooted in the public policy of properly enforcing drunk driving laws and holding drunk drivers to account. And so to the extent that 10 years ago or 15 years ago, some police officer or some prosecutor somewhere intentionally undercharged an OWI, and we all agreed that's bad and they shouldn't have done it. From the city's perspective, it doesn't make any sense to compound that error and continue the error by saying that in the present day, a district attorney can't bring the proper criminal charge, and instead we are going to pretend as if that prior offense never happened at all. In other words, we're essentially looking at a defendant and saying, you drove drunk, and that's bad. You should have been penalized more harshly than you were, and that's wrong. You were punished, but not as severely as you should have been. So as a remedy or as a cure for that, we are not going to punish you at all, and we are going to pretend as if that offense didn't happen. The city submits that a rule that results in that is the outcome does not appropriately address public safety and the strict enforcement of OWI laws.
Okay. I'm sorry. Can I just ask one follow-up to that? What if it's not an intentional non-charging, as if we know it, but we just want to do the forfeiture route anyway for whatever reason, which was the Roehner case, basically, right? Roehner case. What if they think there might have been one, but because it was out of state or for whatever reason there's a lack of records, and of course the criminal defendant has, or the defendant here has no obligation to sort of turn over incriminating evidence against themselves, how would that factor into your analysis? So there might be one. We think there might be one. We don't know if we can prove it, and so we're going to bring it to the municipal court in that situation. How does that factor into your subject matter / competency argument?
I think the outcome there would essentially be the same. In other words, it is being presented to the municipal court as a forfeiture action under municipal ordinances, which is the type of case a municipal court can hear. The competency question fundamentally is whether or not the statutory requirements in order for the municipal court to exercise that jurisdiction have been met. So just like in Booth, if a defendant believes that the municipal court lacks the competency because of the existence of some prior offense, it is incumbent on the party believing that there is no competency to raise that objection in a timely fashion. Otherwise, the court may consider that argument to have been waived. Now, the sort of corollary issue there, or subsequent issue there, is whether or not a prosecutor with actual knowledge of a prior offense who brings the first offense case before the court is somehow engaged in a lack of candor or some other ethical issue with respect to that. And I think that's a little bit of a subsidiary issue here, because there's no information in this record to suggest that's what happened here.
To me, that might be an ethical issue or lack of candor to the court issue, or even an electability issue, if you are purposefully, as a prosecutor, downplaying charges, especially when they come to things like OWI. That's not generally tolerated very well. Having said that, I have had cases where, back when I was a trial judge, and I know that was a while ago, one of the defenses raised by defense lawyers would be, the state can't prove this prior. And I then would say to the state, because back then they actually had to prove that they were sufficiently similar, there were certain criteria they had to meet, and I'd say, you have to prove this. And then the state would have to go to Texas or Florida or whatever and try to get the documents to prove that back then the charge had the requisite elements. And sometimes they couldn't prove it. So as a trial judge, if the state can't prove the prior to the requisite standard, then it had to be tried as a different offense, the lesser offense, I think. I think of all the things that potentially could have been and could be unwound depending on how we decide this case, because I don't necessarily think defense counsel has to, or at least I think defense lawyers don't think they need to. They can't lie to the court, but they can find a way to not answer that question and not throw their client under the bus, right? So if the prosecutor doesn't know, or if the prosecutor's put to the standard of proof and the judge can't make the requisite finding such that it stands as a third or fourth or whatever, because you try things differently, it becomes a .02 if it's something, it's a .08 if it's, I mean, things, it's a felony if it's one thing, it's not if it's enough. It makes it, it's civil versus criminal. It's a big deal to prove the priors. And if that doesn't happen, what are trial judges to do with these?
Right. And I think one of the principles that might apply in that particular fact scenario is the principle of judicial estoppel. In other words, if a defendant affirmatively comes into a court on a criminal charge and says, Your Honor, this prior from Texas shouldn't count because it's not substantially similar under 343-307, or there isn't enough documentary evidence for the state to meet its burden of proof that it even exists. I think my mic, oh, there we go. If that were to happen, a defendant comes in and convinces a court that, you're right, it's not a prior offense. I think that defendant would then be judicially estopped from challenging a municipal court prosecution that resulted from a court so finding.
So let's just turn to the language of the statute, because the language of the statute as it currently stands includes a lot of things, not just operating while intoxicated or prohibited alcohol concentration convictions.
Right.
It includes refusals. It includes other things that are in the statute. So obviously you don't necessarily need the prior offense and the prior offense to have a particular number affixed to it, right?
Correct.
Someone who had two OWIs in different states and then comes to Wisconsin, so long as they're within 10 years, the first one in Wisconsin would be charged as a third, right?
Correct.
So the language of the statute just talks about prior offenses. It doesn't necessarily label how you count those, right?
343-307 lists a whole list of various things that count. It counts convictions, and there is a particular statutory definition to conviction that is frankly broader than what the common understanding of conviction is. It includes operating privilege revocations and suspensions for implied consent refusals, as that term is substantially similarly used in other jurisdictions. It includes things like tribal court adjudications. It even includes Wisconsin convictions for flying while intoxicated. There's a long list of things there. And I think one of the notable things about what counts as a prior offense, conviction, revocation, suspension, what have you, is that the legislature has stated that those can originate from any other jurisdiction. And the statutes define other jurisdiction in 340.01 sub 41M to be essentially anywhere in the United States and Canada, including United States territories. So a defendant could have an implied consent refusal from Guam. Or a defendant could have an administrative action against a driver's license from Newfoundland. And under the Wisconsin statutes, those count as prior offenses.
Even if they're both firsts?
Correct.
Under your argument, the expectation would be that a defendant sitting in municipal court that is supposed to be in criminal court is supposed to raise his or her hand and say, sorry, you should really be charging me with a crime. Because otherwise, under your calling this competency and not subject matter with the definition of arising, otherwise they can't raise it later. So they're essentially supposed to potentially incriminate themselves.
The city's argument is they can't have it both ways, essentially.
Well, it's not them having it, though, is it? I don't quite understand that they can't have it both ways. The state has an obligation, or the city, to research whether or not they have priors. That's how it works. Defendants don't have to research the evidence against them. That's not how our system works, right?
I agree that a defendant has no obligation to affirmatively state that they have prior offenses. They have a constitutional right to remain silent. But I also don't think that police officers, dispatchers, and municipalities have an obligation to be omniscient.
Well, what is omniscient? We've got computers these days. This was a mistake on the part of the municipality, and the outcome that you're saying is because they called it something, because they called it what it, they called it an ordinance, regardless of the fact that it wasn't, that this, it gets to remain, essentially, even though there was no potentially subject matter jurisdiction over it.
Well, I think it's an oversimplification to say we have computers, the city should have found this. Because the reality is that interstate reporting of OWI convictions, revocations, and suspensions often does not work as well as it's supposed to. For instance, essentially only dispatchers have the ability to run an interstate criminal history check through NCIC. That's not something an officer can do.
Well, but a municipal prosecutor can, as can a state prosecutor. We did it all the time.
It's possible for me to ask a dispatcher to do that, but I think that raises a question of, you know, exactly what is it that we think municipal prosecutors have an obligation to do in every single case. And even if you look at those interstate criminal history records, those criminal history records may be deficient.
So couldn't you err on the side of sending it to a circuit court? Because under Booth, if you're wrong, the circuit court can still hear it. Isn't that the solution to all this? A circuit court has the ability, those prosecutors routinely order interstate records. There's time then to actually examine this. And if you're wrong, then they retain jurisdiction.
So under the Wisconsin Constitution and the statutes placing the Wisconsin Constitution into effect, municipal courts have exclusive subject matter jurisdiction over ordinances arising under the municipal ordinances. So in other words, a municipality would not be able to bring that forfeiture action in circuit court if the municipality has a circuit court. That's what I believe it's 755-035 sets forth.
Except under Booth.
But Booth didn't deal with an issue of municipal court jurisdiction.
Counsel, just to follow up on that, you know my question about these examples of something that's charged earlier, your response was one of public policy, and your response to Justice Ziegler's questions were ones of judicial estoppel. And I'm curious, those seem like very different things to me than subject matter jurisdiction and competency. I mean, that's its own framework, its own analysis. And I took those as maybe alternative ways you might win. And so I guess I'd like you to go back to the subject matter jurisdiction and competency piece. I mean, the sort of general rule is municipal courts only have the jurisdiction that have been conferred upon them by statute. They have no other jurisdiction beyond that. And when if they've got a case in front of them, they didn't have jurisdiction to hear in the first place, maybe that wouldn't be there. Now, I understand your argument is the result is anomalous and it makes no sense whatsoever. And it is incredibly odd to me that we could have a statutory scheme where, the jurisdictions that have municipal courts, you could have something voided, and the jurisdictions that don't, it wouldn't be because it'd be charged in circuit court. That's an odd result. However, it could also be that the legislature poorly design the law and leads to really, really odd and inconsistent results for different people. And the legislature should fix it by, for example, making clear that that this wouldn't constitute a forfeiture of jurisdiction potentially under these kinds of circumstances. Or there's other sorts of legislative ways you might fix it. So anyway, just curious if you could go back to the competency and jurisdiction argument, which seems to me very different than estoppel.
Sure. And just to respond a little bit to what you were stating there, even if the legislature were to, you know, somehow fix this tomorrow, perhaps they were to simply criminalize OWI first going forward, for example, there are still about 2.5 decades worth of municipal court first offense OWI convictions that are out there some of which may have been mistakenly entered because there was an unknown prior conviction. So it doesn't necessarily solve the issue looking
sure.
back.
Just to be clear, I understand it's a real problem. I mean, Justice Ziegler's point, you know, is a real one about potentially failure of proof and how that might impact, you know, might impact things. But this has been kind of the general understanding for some time. There's been cases that have been out there, like Stroman and others, that apply this general framework and lead to results that are sometimes head-scratchers, but seem to apply the subject matter jurisdiction line in a firmer way that doesn't translate naturally over into, it doesn't fit with our subject matter competency as judges.
And I think Booth really sort of changed that particular framework. Stroman and all those other cases were decided pre-Booth, so they didn't have the benefit of Booth delineating what is a competency issue versus what is a jurisdiction issue. And I think if there's one takeaway from Booth, it is that the OWI penalty scheme set forth in 346.65 sub 2, that violations of that are fundamentally a matter of court competency. And because that is the statutory deficit in circuit court, the same as it would be in municipal court, because that's a narrower individual case focus, that's what the emphasis should be when looking at a municipal court case as well.
So if, oh, I'm sorry, never mind. Your red light's on.
Thank you.
So is mine.
Well, may it please the court and Chief Justice Rogensack. My name is Andrew Mishlov, and I have the great honor to represent the respondent, Reese Hansen, who is present in his proper person. I see this case as involving three areas, and I'd like to address the area that I think is least relevant, but in some ways most important first, and that would be the ethical considerations and the relative duties of counsel. The court has asked questions about that, and I don't think there's much dispute, but it bears repeating. There's also policy issues that have to be addressed, and of course the jurisprudential conundrum. But just in terms of the ethical issue, as to the duties of counsel, the justices are quite correct. Defendants and defense counsel do not have the duty to provide prosecutors with incriminating information, and in fact, there is a recent State Bar Professional Ethics Committee opinion specifically as to OWI priors. It is opinion E8606, which opines that in the counting of OWI priors, when defense counsel or defendant knows that the prosecution has undercounted, which is what occurred in this case, and it occurs, I wouldn't say frequently, but occasionally, that the duty of defense counsel is to refrain from any misleading conduct or any misleading statements. We all know that. But also to refrain from volunteering any incriminating information. And that seems pretty obvious. The reason I say that it bears repeating is because my learned friend's brief used phrases like lack of candor, gaming the system. There's language in the Booth case with respectfully that talks about fast and loose with the system. And I just think that language is unfortunate. These cases arise when defendants and defense counsel are doing what they're supposed to do.
Counsel, is it your understanding of your opposing counsel's position that this 2005 conviction should be counted as a second offense, criminal offense? Is that your understanding of their position?
No, I think he's saying just the opposite. He's saying that the municipal court had jurisdiction over this, that the competency objection was forfeited, therefore this is a valid but voidable conviction. It's our position this is a void conviction, that the municipal court never had jurisdiction, and frankly the city hasn't pointed to any constitutional or statutory provision that confers jurisdiction.
The reason I ask that question is your comment, as you started out, about the ethical opinion of lawyers, which made me think of if this is counted as a second offense, was there a lawyer present? And, of course, in a criminal case, you have the right to have a lawyer. He pled guilty here to the charge, and the BAC charge was dismissed. Was there a lawyer present here?
I believe this municipal conviction was done by written stipulation and executed by counsel, yes. And I may add that there were criminal charges issued arising out of the same incident where he was represented. So both the municipal attorney and the district attorney had their hands on this incident.
And the issue isn't whether under the statute it is a second offense. The issue for purposes of counting is whether it's a prior offense that would count. And let's just say there were two first offenses, one in Michigan and one in Minnesota, both first offenses. They both would count, and if they were in the requisite time period in Wisconsin, it'd be a third, right?
Correct. And in fact, that happens frequently under Wisconsin's 10-year look back from second to first, but lifetime look back on third. So we often see two firsts and then a third.
Right. So it's not that it's a first, second, it's just... So that then gets to part of the rub here, which is they should have probably charged it as a second. For whatever reason, they didn't. Does that become jurisdictional when they make a mistake in that regard? And what would make it jurisdictional? Does it make it jurisdictional because of the words of the Constitution? Does it make it jurisdictional because of the language in some cases? Does it make it jurisdictional because it's in the penalty phase of the statutes? Is it competency? What makes it jurisdictional? Is it the legislative choice to require prosecutors to charge considering priors? And what's the penalty if prosecutors don't properly find the Guam conviction?
Thank you. I think you've touched on the issue. It's all those things. I think the reason we don't have a lot of law in the state of Wisconsin on the subject matter jurisdiction and is it factual or is it legal and how does it arise and how do we determine it is because circuit courts are courts of general subject matter jurisdiction. But if we were to look to the jurisprudence of courts of limited jurisdiction, and I'm speaking of federal courts, which all are of limited jurisdiction, there is a wealth of very complex jurisprudence on issues of jurisdictional fact. And when is a factual dispute jurisdictional, and when is a factual dispute simply a matter of the merits of the claim, and so on.
Counsel, you would agree that there was personal jurisdiction over Mr. Hansen, correct?
I do.
Okay, so if we would agree with your position and think that conviction should be vacated, can it now be refiled?
Actually, perhaps. There's a statute of limitations issue because of the passage of time, but under the Dielke case, if a court were to find that by making the motion to vacate the conviction, Mr. Hansen violated the terms of that plea agreement, the statute would be told. So potentially, this Cedarburg incident from 2005 could be prosecuted in criminal court.
But statute of limitations, isn't that a defense to personal jurisdiction?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Perhaps I misunderstood the question.
Oh, you understood the question quite right. I'm just asking you a different question now. I don't think it's subject matter jurisdiction. I think it's personal jurisdiction.
I honestly don't know. Certainly a defense that a defendant has to raise.
That's right.
I honestly don't know whether it's a defense that can be waived.
Okay.
So the question is this issue of subject matter jurisdiction, as counsel suggests, merely a matter of pleading? If the city issues a uniform traffic citation, does that alleges a municipal ordinance violation in strict conformity with the statute, Their position is that confers subject matter jurisdiction and that any factual dispute simply goes to competence. That's boiling it down, and that's just not in keeping with American jurisprudence on factual disputes that are jurisdictional.
And counsel, you've moved to have the judgment of conviction vacated. I mean, that's your motion, right, that you brought in the circuit court?
Yes.
Did I speak correctly? You brought that in the circuit court?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And the remedy, if there was no subject matter jurisdiction for entering the judgment of conviction, what's the remedy?
It is to vacate the judgment and hold that it is a void and it's a nullity. It has no effect. It doesn't bar a subsequent prosecution. Any funds paid in are returned. It cannot be counted. It also means that there's no double jeopardy argument that a defendant could make, saying that the prior prosecution barred a subsequent prosecution.
Why doesn't that have to be brought in municipal court?
I'm sorry?
The circuit court takes the appeals from the municipal court. If they're appealing something from the municipal court, then it goes to the circuit court. But this was not appealed to the circuit court. Now you're in circuit court asking the circuit court to undo the municipal court. Citation, why didn't you bring the motion to the municipal court?
The procedural history of this is a little convoluted. I initially made a collateral attack in the circuit court in a pending case that's charged as a third offense,
right,
and I won that motion. Then,
which was kind of like when someone challenges the Texas conviction, you can't use that as a prior, they can't prove that happened, and then you try it as a second or a first because it's not a third or a second, right? That's very similar to that judicial estoppel kind of thing.
I would say it was done as a collateral attack, which was more similar to an attack under Ernst Pickens' classic line of cases. Mm-hmm. I then, frankly, realized that under the Hamill case, that was procedurally inappropriate, and I had an ethical duty to bring that to the attention of the court. Did so, went back to the municipal court, made a motion to vacate. So that's why the city, rather than the state, is the appellant here.
And the municipal court granted it?
The municipal court denied the motion to vacate. I then appealed to circuit court, where Judge Malloy granted the motion to vacate. And Judge Malloy's decision, really, we think, was right on. He didn't deny that this is an issue of competency, but he also said that before you even get to the competency question, we have to figure out where is their subject matter jurisdiction. There is no subject matter jurisdiction. Therefore, competency is just not at issue, and he granted the motion to vacate.
Counsel, when you're collaterally attacking a prior conviction here, is there anything in our case law, and this more goes to the estoppel question, I suppose, but, you know, your client could have challenged the municipal conviction as soon as it happened, right? I mean, you could have appealed it theoretically or even at the time and didn't, that you had no authority to bring this charge. And I get it, that puts your client in a difficult spot, but, what do we make of the idea that this was a challenge you could have made at a prior point, but didn't? And part of it is I'm thinking about, the kind of claims that run through our court system all the time, where you see a direct appeal that works its way up, and then you see the, 974-06 motion that makes arguments. And generally, our rule has been, partially based on that statute, that if it was an argument you could have made earlier, you need to. You don't get to raise something brand new that you knew about and make a totally brand new argument on a normal kind of collateral attack on a conviction.
Your Honor, I appreciate the question, and that, of course, is what counsel is arguing. That places upon a defendant a burden to incriminate himself, which is a defense counsel certainly can't do that. A defendant is constitutionally protected from that. And it does lead to this head-scratching result, as you say. And I can't deny that. But may I add that the policy reasons that underlie the Roner case, and which were certainly reaffirmed in the Booth case, are still in place. And that policy was to enforce the drunk driving laws and deter drunk driving. And I have to, moving on to the policy issues, say that if this court were to find that municipal courts have subject matter jurisdiction over matters that are actually criminal, that means that under statute 345.21 sub 1, not to mention the potential constitutional issues.
Well, it's not actually criminal until it's charged as a crime. I mean, this really was charged as a first. There's no indication that someone was trying to game the system. It was tried as a first. The proper burden of proof occurred. He was represented by counsel. So, I mean, but for the statute that requires prosecutors to find out what the priors are and then charge them, this was done right. I mean, if this were a first and there wasn't the prior out there, you wouldn't be here claiming that somehow this trial was faulty. It was properly tried as a first or properly agreed to as a first, right?
I agree that if this had been a first offense, in fact, the municipal court procedures would have been proper. But because there is a jurisdictional fact that it was actually a second offense, a municipal court could not have heard it, and the judgment is void. And it is an issue of jurisdictional fact.
Well, that goes back to counsel, I believe, the question of do we look at what the facts of the offense are or what was charged? Which one do we look at?
Well, I think under the law, and I think it fits with the law of subject matter jurisdiction of courts of limited jurisdiction in general, you have to look at both.
Right.
It is in part a factual determination.
All right. So let's start with page 5 of your brief, where you say municipalities should not have the authority to prosecute criminal incidents, right?
Yes.
Okay. Did the municipality in this case attempt to prosecute a criminal incident?
It did not prosecute it as a criminal offense, but it was as alleged now, or as we know now, a criminal incident. I chose the word incident carefully.
And I think you were wise to do so. But the question is, did the municipal court have the jurisdiction to hear what was charged? Isn't it?
The municipal court had jurisdiction to hear a case that was, in fact, a first offense. But since this was a second offense, it is in part a factual issue.
Yeah,
that's our position.
So you're fast-forwarding to the end of the story. I understand why you want to do that. But let's look at this in the temporal manner in which it all unfolded. Right. So there was Mr. Hansen was charged with a first offense.
Yes.
OWI.
Yes.
Okay. And so given the jurisdictional and statutory requirements, that was presented in the municipal court. Yeah?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear, Your Honor.
Sure. So given the constitutional and statutory requirements, that charge was presented in the municipal court because it was charged as a first offense.
It adhered with the requirements for a first offense, yes.
Okay. And the municipal court has the authority to hear charges of first offense OWI.
If they are, in fact, first offenses.
And now, you're fast-forwarding to the end again.
I understand.
So you're getting to a question of evidentiary facts.
Yes.
What I'm looking at is a question of jurisdictional fact. What was alleged? And what was alleged was the first offense OWI. Right?
Yes.
And we agree that the municipal court has the authority to hear first offense OW.
Agreed.
So that's what the municipality attempted to do. Now, if if there had been a failure of evidence, then there'd be no conviction, correct?
True. Yes.
All right. Now, the difficulty here, of course, is that the failure of evidence could not be argued by his defense counsel because that would subject him to greater liability. But we're still talking about a failure of evidence, aren't we?
I would say no. We're talking about, I can't agree with that. The law of jurisdictional facts makes a distinction between facts that go to the merits and facts that are jurisdictional facts. In federal court, for example, somebody might say that you haven't alleged a federal question. It is a matter of jurisdictional fact, and let's say an employment discrimination case, and it will be decided as a on summary judgment. But it would require affidavits that allege facts. So there's this category of factual disputes that are not, that do not go to just the merits of the case. They
right.
are jurisdictional facts.
Yeah. So let's look at the federal jurisdictional question. So so a complaint alleges some cause of action that gets you into federal court, right? Let's say that it was a matter of an incident that occurred across state lines. And so the complaint outlines all the facts that it believes establish that jurisdiction.
Yes.
All right. Now, now the complaint goes to trial, and it turns out not all of this happened in multiple states, right?
Yes.
So now what happens? Is that a failure of the claim, or did the court never have jurisdiction to hear the case?
Actually, I brought with me a law review article on point, as well as a Supreme Court case.
I'll take the Supreme Court case first, thank you.
Pardon me?
I'll take the Supreme Court case over the law review article.
The answer to your question is that there's a complicated body of law on whether facts go to the merits or whether they're jurisdictional facts, and it's an important question. If they are jurisdictional facts, that means they can't be waived, and they can be raised at any time, years later. And in the example Your Honor gave, I would say that's a jurisdictional fact. If it goes to the merits, it has to be raised pursuant to a motion challenging the complaint or a motion for summary judgment, or it's waived.
What's the Supreme Court case?
This is a case on employment discrimination where the issue was whether the 15-person trigger for federal jurisdiction, 15-person in terms of 15 employees, is a fact that goes to the merits or a jurisdictional fact, and Justice Ginsburg, in general, discusses the issue. It's Arbaugh, A-R-B-A-U-G-H, versus Y and H Corporation at, I'm sorry, I only have the Supreme Court reporter citation, 126 Supreme Court, 1235, 2006.
Thank you.
Counsel, imagine for a moment that prosecutors or municipal prosecutors think they know about a prior offense, talk about it with your client, but don't feel like they can prove it. And so, you know, your client doesn't volunteer anything. You assert, hey, if you try to raise that prior offense, we'll challenge it. So there's an agreement to go ahead and treat this as a first offense municipal violation. Do you see any problem with years after that, when charged with another OWI, going back and now saying, aha, in fact, I did do it, and therefore you should void the whole thing? Do you see any merit to some sort of estoppel-type argument that could be appropriately brought to bear in that situation?
I would say, Your Honor, that if that obviously that is a compelling argument. It's what underlies all of this. I would say the issue is estoppel, not forfeiture, but estoppel. And
what would be the boundary lines of that, which is obviously different than subject matter jurisdiction versus competency? It's a separate question.
Yeah. I would simply point out that for cases like that, there are also cases where the existence of a municipal court judgment that is considered valid, even if voidable, by statute and by constitution would bar a criminal prosecution for the same offense that should have been a criminal prosecution. So that fairness and public policy sword cuts in both directions. And in fact, I would point the court to the Kenosha versus Jensen case, which I cited, which those were the facts. Also, there's unpublished decisions. I have three of them here where the same thing was at issue. And the court held that the criminal prosecution on the same incident was valid because the municipal court lacked subject matter jurisdiction. The judgment was void, a nullity, therefore it could not bar the criminal prosecution.
I hear you. And indeed, your motion here is a motion to vacate the judgment of a conviction. Is that correct?
Yes.
I mean, you write, and it's a very short motion. It isn't.
I wonder if your microphone, the other one, is working. Feedback.
Okay. It's probably just us. Don't worry about it. It's just crazy day as far as the sound today.
Is this uniquely a Wisconsin problem then? Because Wisconsin is the only place where it would, or one of very few, that would be a first offense. And so you'd only have this argument in Wisconsin, right? Because if you had a Michigan conviction, an Illinois conviction, and a Minnesota conviction, you would have a fourth in Wisconsin. Even if they're first, second, and thirds, or those other states don't know about each other, and they just charge them all essentially as first offenses, they still would count as priors. But the fact that Wisconsin has a first offense be a civil offense is what gives you the in here to make this argument. Is that true?
Yes.
That's right.
And in this temporal line that we're talking about, that is the charge or the failure of proof, you have fashioned your challenge on the judgment of conviction, which is at the end point of the line, and you say that the judgment of conviction is void because the court lacked subject matter jurisdiction over a second offense. So that's the focus of your claim here, is the judgment of conviction. Is that correct?
For me, counsel, the issue here turns on the meaning within the Constitution, Section 14, which assigns jurisdiction to municipal courts, and it limits that jurisdiction to actions and proceedings arising under ordinances of the municipality. And so I was interested in trying to figure out the meaning of that. I couldn't find a case interpreting that specific language, but I did find a case citing that constitutional provision that was not cited by the parties. It's City of Milwaukee versus Roten, WROTEN 160 with second 207, and it involved a different issue that dealt with the authority of a municipal court to determine the constitutionality of an ordinance. However, in a footnote, the court referenced Section 755.045 sub 1 sub B, and in that statutory provision, the legislature says if equitable relief is demanded, the plaintiff shall bring the action in a court of record. And in footnote 4, the court said the municipal court under those circumstances would be without jurisdiction. So that is my roundabout way of saying that suggests to me that how the case is presented by the parties informs the jurisdictional analysis, because under that provision, if the plaintiff demands equitable relief, the municipal court loses jurisdiction. The plaintiff may not have any basis under law for receiving equitable relief, but it is the mere demand that removes the jurisdiction of the municipal court and then moves it over to the circuit court. So could you respond to that note, footnote 4 in the Roten case?
Well, Your Honor, I think it's both. The subject matter jurisdiction is a matter of the pleadings. The pleadings must state the cause of action within the subject matter jurisdiction of the court. but there are also jurisdictional facts that have to be satisfied for subject matter jurisdiction. The obvious one would be, for example, it has to be within the boundaries of the state of Wisconsin. Or in federal court, for example, if it was an OWI case, it might have to be on a military base where they have no subject matter jurisdiction. These are factual issues. But, of course, the pleadings also have to state a claim within the court's jurisdiction.
But if it's pled that way, if it meets those parameters, then why isn't that enough for the municipal court in this case to have jurisdiction?
Because factually, it didn't have jurisdiction over an incident that was criminal. The same way, even if the city pled that it occurred within the boundaries of the city, but factually it occurred in the state of Illinois, the city wouldn't have subject matter jurisdiction over it.
So let's stress test that a little bit. Let's say that it's questionable whether the municipality would be able to prove the prior OWI offense, right? And so they bring it in circuit courts, and they think they're going to win. I think I'm going to be able to do this, right? And they fail. They can't prove the prior. Now their complaint has failed entirely, correct? Because they've not been able to prove the elements that they charged. Yeah.
I think under Apprendi, you might be correct.
Okay. Yes. Now let's move this over to the circuit court. So they say, you know what? I don't think I'll be able to prove the prior. Yeah. And so they bring it in municipal court with full knowledge that there's another incident hanging around out there, but it's just a question of evidentiary fact. I don't think I'll be able to get it in. Does the municipal court have the authority, the jurisdiction to hear that case?
Courts always have jurisdiction to determine whether or not they have jurisdiction. So I think the municipal court would have to make a determination as to whether it was actually a first or a second offense in order to decide whether or not it had jurisdiction.
Yeah, so maybe the prosecutor says, well, here, I've got a transcript, it's not authenticated. So as an evidentiary matter, I've got an evidentiary problem. But we all know it happened. Can the court say, yeah, we can go ahead with that anyway?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm really having trouble hearing.
Yeah. Sorry, I've got my voice is departing today. So the prosecutor says, I became aware of this prior incident. I've got a transcript of it, but it's not authenticated. It's an evidentiary problem, right? I don't know what to do with this because it's not authenticated, and I'm not sure I can get it in evidence. So, court, what do you think? Municipal court, can you hear this? Can you not hear this?
I think the municipal court would have to make a determination about that. And frankly, it goes back to where I started this argument, which is that defense counsel and defendants don't have a burden, or in fact, it's contrary to our duty to bring forth incriminating evidence, but prosecutors have a duty to figure things out.
All right, so just to wrap this up, I know the red light's on, but just to wrap it up. So the municipal court says, yeah, you got an evidentiary problem, we're going to hear this. Judgment is entered. Later, the prosecutor, he gets that authenticated copy, right? Or the defendant gets the authenticated copy. Can the defendant now come in and say, you've got to vacate the judgment? It turns out I've done this before.
I think that raises the issue that my learned colleague spoke of estoppel, and that would be something the court would have to hear based on all of the facts as to where the equities were. But I don't see it as a question of arguments are waived or forfeited, but rather of estoppel and whether or not it is. And a court, I think, after a hearing and could determine that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I wanted to start off by briefly responding to a question that arose during counsel's argument with respect to with respect to what happens if the circuit court decision and order is affirmed and this conviction gets vacated. I agree that the Department of Transportation would be notified. It would be removed from the defendant's driving record. The defendant would be entitled to a refund of the $705 forfeiture that he paid into the court back in 2005. But most importantly, I believe that under cases such as Stroman and other cases interpreting this issue, recent case State versus Kohlross, the pendency of a first offense municipal court case does not toll the criminal statute of limitations. So because we are far past 3 years from the date of the offense, the state of Wisconsin would have no ability to charge the defendant for the 2005 incident.
Well, do you agree that there was personal jurisdiction when the matter began in municipal court?
Yes, when he was personally served with the citation under Section 800.01, that's sufficient.
Well,
to
and is statute of limitations a matter of personal jurisdiction or subject matter jurisdiction?
I believe that statute of limitations is, it's either a personal jurisdiction issue or it's frankly a competency issue because it's a factual inquiry into whether the statutory requirements for bringing that case have been met.
Okay, so if it's personal jurisdiction and you had personal jurisdiction over him and statute of limitations can be waived, I think we all know that. You're still in your same position. You can't charge him. That's your position.
Right. I think a recent case...
I'm sure he's happy with that.
What's that?
I'm sure he's happy with that.
What about counsel's argument? And I was thinking the same as you just said, but the argument was just potentially made about the fact that he entered into a plea agreement and then under, I think I wrote down the Dilkey case, that perhaps there is a potential there to challenge that plea agreement.
So two things on that, Justice Allitt. First, I'm not entirely sure that I would necessarily characterize a stipulation to enter a no-contest plea as a plea agreement the same way that it's used in a criminal case. The second thing is, and if you look at the actual stipulation, which I believe I included in the appendix, yes, it's page 137 in the blue brief. There is nothing in that stipulation where the defendant makes a representation to the city or to the court as to the lack of prior offenses. In other words, it's silent on that issue. If the city had said, for example, sure, we'll stipulate that you can plead no contest, but you have to sign something saying, you know, I affirm that I have no prior countable offenses anywhere, then perhaps there would be an estoppel argument. But the big asterisk to that is case law that was pre-Booth that looks at issues of void judgments and subject matter jurisdiction suggests that you can never assent or consent to a void judgment.
Counsel, what about the city of Kenosha versus Jensen case, though? In that case, as I look at my notes, the state arguably would be free to re-prosecute the defendant for OWI second as a criminal offense consistent with the penalty structure instituted by the legislature. It said this: the municipal judgment having no force or effect, it is as if it never took place and jeopardy never attached. How do you respond to that?
Two responses to that, Justice Bradley. First, in making that proclamation in Jensen, the court relied solely on Walworth County versus Rohner and Rohner's interpretation of this as a subject matter jurisdiction issue. This court in Booth withdrew the language from Rohner and any other case that views the issue in that lens.
Isn't that an argument that we have here, and that is what language from Rohner was indeed withdrawn, right? I mean, isn't that what you folks are arguing about and we have to decide? So maybe, maybe not, depending
right.
on, we look at it and say, what language was actually withdrawn?
And if I may continue with my response, I think Booth clarified that when Rohner couched the issue in terms of subject matter jurisdiction, it really meant competency, and therefore I think in Jensen should be interpreted the same way as well. The second point is, I agree that the under State versus Thierfelder, the existence of a municipal court civil prosecution is not a jeopardy bar to a subsequent or even concurrent criminal prosecution. So I agree that the state had the authority at the time to bring the second offense charge. Of course, the issue is they don't get it to review unless the arresting officer knows that it's a second offense to even send it to the district attorney in the first place.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, we hear a lot of OWI cases, and this is certainly a very interesting one. So thank you all for bringing it to us. We're going to take a recess now until 1:30 when our third case of the day. We are adjourned.